this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. Well, this evening, for the first hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. Jim Guest, who is going to be talking about the real ID card, and he's a member of the legislature. Well, I'm going to let him tell you just a little bit about himself. We've had him on as a guest before, and always a very, very welcome guest here at Radio Liberty. Mr. Guest, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on again and glad to share my message with the listeners around this country and around the world, wherever they're listening in tonight.
All right, fine. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You are a legislature. Whereabouts?
I'm a legislature in Missouri here. I live in northwest Missouri. I've got an engineering background, and I came back to the farm several years ago, and I'm a small businessman, starting some small businesses and other things. And about 6 years ago, I decided the opportunity was there for me to get into public service, so I ran as a state representative here in Missouri, and I've been elected to, three times now, and be running again for my fourth term next year. I've served on the Workforce Development Corrections Committees, and I've been chair of the Fiscal Review Committee here in Missouri for the last 2 years. As chairman of the Fiscal Review, any bill that comes through the state legislature that impacts the cost of it over $100,000 either way has to come from my committee for approval after it's had action on the floor. So I'm somewhat of a checks and balance there, and just have some influence on if I think our state is getting too extravagant in its spending. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the RFID cards, because I think that this is something that people have to understand. There really are people who have a different worldview, and they want every person in this country numbered. Now, we were promised that our Social Security card number would never be used for anything but Social Security, and we only had to have that number because government loved us so much and wanted to give us money when we got old and couldn't work. But, of course, that was, like so many government promises, not true. They want every person numbered, and now they want everybody to eventually be forced to carry a card. They want to have RFID chips on every cow, and you see the cows now, they have these little green tags on their ears, but so many of them carry RFID, identification. What's this really all about, in your estimation?
I think you came very close to covering all of it. It's the goal of those in our government to track us. I probably started working on this 2 or 3 years ago when the Real ID Act was passed, part of H.R. 418 in our U.S. Congress. H.R. 418 was a bill to provide about $82 billion in supplemental war effort for our soldiers, and also some charitable tsunami relief there. You know, two probably well-meaning things. So it was something that most members of Congress could not vote against.
But, of course, it had another little something on there.
Yes.
And, of course, that's
late one night in the House, they decided, I think, Dr. James Sensenbrenner, a representative, added what was called the Real ID Act onto it.
All right, fine. So this is what they do, of course, so often to get to what they really want.
Mm-hmm. It was added there, and, without very little debate, and when there weren't the Senate side, they never even had a debate on the Senate. It was voted out without any opposition. And lo and behold, what seemed like a very harmless bill contained the Real ID Act, and that is where we really have some serious problems facing us in the future. The Department of Homeland Security said that starting in May of 2008, you got to have a real ID card if you want to get on the federally regulated airplane or enter any federal building or any nuclear power plant.
Well, now, I thought this was all about terrorism. This is about stopping terrorism.
Oh, yes.
But certainly, are the terrorists going to have their RFID cards? Are all the terrorists going to abide by our laws? Or is this simply for the law-abiding citizens?
That's what it is. Why, if we're concerned about terrorists, are we putting this on the backs of the freedom-loving Americans? That is the fault in this. And actually, the National ID card, which is what it is, even though they say it's not, you know, they've been trying to get this passed for probably 30 years. In the Carter administration, they tried to get it implemented. In the Reagan administration, he outright told them it wasn't going to have it. And in the Clinton administration, they did kind of have an ID card attached to a bill, which was passed, but there was such a public outcry on it, it was taken out. So all they needed was a reason for it or an excuse, and when 9/11 happened, you know, the threat of terror or threat of another outbreak, they were able to slip it through at that point. And they say, well, we need to have a more secure driver's license. And to do that, you know, to stop terrorism, because the terrorist had some more than one driver's license. However, there's some fault in what they're saying there. The terrorists got their driver's license basically using the passport from some of the countries they came from. Those passports, which we accept, were stolen. So we have no way of controlling the authenticity or the accuracy of the passports when somebody from another country comes in. So that's where the policy comes in. They say they want to control terrorists. Well, let's target the terrorists, as you say. Let's not target those who are in this country, not causing any problems. I don't think the 80-year-old grandmother gets on an airplane is much of a threat, at least not in Missouri.
Well, I don't think so in much of the country at all. But, of course, this is really a long-range plan, and it's so difficult, I think, for many Americans to believe that there really would be those out there who are not interested at all in fighting terrorism, but are more interested in controlling and numbering and watching and observing and tracking law-abiding citizens, especially those like yourself and myself, who understand that there is a plan to do away with our sovereignty and bring us under the control of this ruling elite. We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Jim Guest, who's a legislator in the state of Missouri, and he's been very concerned about this RFID card, this tracking card. They say it's just to be actually a driver's license, a secured, and of course we know it's a right driver's license because it has an RFID chip in it, and somehow by getting every American to have to carry one of these cards, we're going to defeat Osama bin Laden, who wants to take away our freedom. And so by giving up our freedom and allowing us to be ourselves to be tracked, we're going to thwart the desires of the evil Osama bin Laden. So how do we counteract something like this? Because there's so many people who just blindly follow along whatever the government tells them without ever stopping and questioning what's really going on.
I think part of it, as you say, you know, a lot of people, it's slowly being implemented in various ways without the people's knowledge of what's on there. You know, they say they want, they say, yeah, this card has to have what they call a common machine-readable technology. So that's a barcode on it, on the back. However, they've backed off strongly saying it's going to have an RFID chip initially. What people need to know is the Department of Homeland Security has told, there is no judicial, there is no legislative oversight on this. If this is not stopped, we're giving them a blank check to increase any requirements in the future on it. And you can be assured that there will be a requirement that it have an RFID chip in it. And when that chip is placed in it, then we found out a few states have some RFID chips already in their driver's license, that this enables the government to keep track of you. All these databases, the states have to keep a database on you when you go get your new card with all your information on it. And with this big link, all you have to do is link into your Social Security number, and you can download and get whatever information that's on you or anybody can. So that is where the problem comes in there, that we are becoming less secure instead of more secure. And the people think that with this real ID card that they will feel a little bit more secure. In essence, it's a false sense of security when this goes through.
And I think it's like with so many things. Initially, the American citizens invested literally hundreds of billions of dollars in defensive actions to protect us from the wicked communists. And we had to have these satellites that were to be up in space spying on the wicked communists. But now, of course, those same military satellites that have been used in the past to spy on the wicked communists are now being converted to civilian use so they can spy on the American people, not on the terrorists, because we don't care about terrorists. We haven't tried to seal our borders at all. Any effort to seal our borders has been effectively blocked, so we know that they're not really tracking the terrorists, but they are monitoring every American. In fact, they can even tell the quality of your roof. They can look at the shingles on your roof. The technology is that good. Designed to spy on the Soviets, but now, of course, spying on the American people. Well, how are we going to convince the American people that they really have to be concerned about freedom, Jim? So many people take freedom for granted here without recognizing that our founding fathers feared government more than anything. They feared that the power of government would eventually one day be used against the people. How are we going to get people to understand the American dream is based upon limiting the power of the government so men could be free?
You're right on the target there. We're supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not a government to be feared. It's the role of government to protect our freedoms, not to take them away, and certainly not by those who we elect and put in power to protect us. And do you know who is running our Department of Homeland Security on this real ID thing?
Oh, I don't know. Who is it?
We have five or six ex-KGB agents. Now, the KGB in Russia, were they working for the government or were they working with people? You know they were working for the government. They had people spying on each other. They had people carrying cards around so they could keep track of those. And that's exactly who we have over here instituting this program. So they are very knowledgeable on how to set up a program for the government to track you, to watch you, and know where you're going. You talk about losing our freedom. We will be losing it in huge chunks. And I say right now, this country is at the crossroads. Our future is at stake now. If we go down this road and this real ID is implemented, we're going to lose some freedoms that we will never get out. You know, the Constitution was in 1876, you know, it was founded in the Bill of Rights to establish and to protect our rights. That's rights of freedom of religion, speech, the right to bear arms, the right of assembly, the protection of our privacy and our personal papers, and that is what we're losing here. What protection do we have when the government can look into our bank accounts, monitor where we're going? That is what the Constitution was supposed to protect. I just kind of wonder what our forefathers would think if they were to come back and look at their country now. This is the country that, you know, they fought for. They put their lives and their whatever business had on the line when they signed that Constitution. You know, they felt like freedom meant that much to them. Do the people in this country still value freedom that much? At least the people like you and I and others value the freedom enough that we're willing to fight for, but we've got to get the rest of the people to realize the danger that's confronting us now.
Well, of course, the thing is, you're in the state legislature. Do you think that the average member of your legislature understands the American Constitution? Do you think that they can understand that the whole purpose of our federal government was to limit the power of government, and that was the function of the Bill of Rights? Are they aware that our founding fathers feared the power of government, or are they simply doing what's sort of expedient? You know, this sounds like a good idea. Let's do it. After all, we've got to counter Osama bin Laden, because if we don't have everybody carrying one of these cards, Osama bin Laden's going to be able to take away our freedom.
Yep, the 10th Amendment says, and our forefathers were so intelligent, maybe they had some divine intervention there when they set that up. You know, it's it says that the federal government, it says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states or to the people. The only power that the federal government has is what we give them or what's not prohibited by them. And they have certainly overstepped that bounds I don't know how much they've overstepped it in the last few years. They have forgotten what the Constitution is. I think we need to make sure at the beginning of each session in every state and at the U.S., at the Washington, D.C., that they read through that Constitution at the beginning of the session so that they understand what they're supposed to be governing by.
Well, I certainly think so. The thing is that certainly every state legislator, when he is sworn in, has to swear to uphold the Constitution, and not only of the state, but of the federal government, and defend that Constitution of the United States against enemies both foreign and domestic. And nobody ever asks who those domestic enemies are, but I would like to suggest they're the people who want to change our form of government and have a different world view. And unfortunately, the average individual finds it so difficult to believe that there would be people here in the United States who don't believe in freedom, whose loyalty is to this globalist idea, this globalist concept of a ruling elite, because us common people are just too stupid to know what's best for us.
Yep, I say our country and its citizens are under attack. But this time it's not from outside, but it's from within our borders, you know. I think as Americans, we're having our rights and freedoms stripped away from us at an alarming rate. And that's under this administration, and as I said earlier, this almost a KGB-style Homeland Security. We must protect our country on our shores from those who would want to destroy our way of life. And we are the people of a great nation if we protect the liberty by which it was founded. But then I think, as you mentioned earlier, the dangers our founding fathers worried about was our complacent nature when we become prosperous, when we take for granted that these freedoms are always going to be here. So,
amen to that. For our listeners out there, there's a wonderful book called Spy Chip, which we do carry, and we have a number of interviews with Catherine Albrecht and with Liz, her friend, Liz McIntyre, who's written extensively about this. Are you acquainted with Liz's, Catherine Albrecht's work on the RFID chip?
I haven't read any of her books. I've read some articles that she's put out, and, you know, she's right on target with that about the threat of what's coming with that, yes.
And not only that, but they're chipping the animals on all of our farms. They want to be able to identify every animal that's out there, even the little chickens. Well, of course, if you're a big chicken farmer, all the eggs are born on, hatched on one day, and they can all be put into the same number. But if you're a small chicken farmer with a few hundred chickens and they hatch on different days, you have to have a separate RFID number and a chip on those. And I don't even know how you're going to be able to band all your chickens with different RFID tags. And certainly we know that they're already forcing the farmers to have their RFID on their cattle. And they even want the farmer to have to report if that cow is moved from one field to another. They want to know where all the cows in America are. How in heaven's name are they ever going to track all the cows? I mean, they can't even track the money that
billions of dollars
they send to Iraq.
There are some farmers throughout this country that are just outraged at the thought of this. You know, my position on this is if you want to put chips in your animals, if it's market-driven, you should be free to do that. You know, it should be market-driven for you to do that, to identify your animal. But you should not be forced to do this by our federal government. And that's certainly where we differ on this.
And of course, it's going to be prohibitively expensive for the small farmer, but then there's some very large farmers who don't like the competition. What a wonderful thing to do, to use the federal government to get rid of your competition by making impossible demands on them that you don't have to abide by yourself. Well, Jim, so how are we going to reach the legislators? Because certainly one of the most important things is is to get the state legislators to understand. And what are they doing in your state? Are the people in your state going to go along with the RFID, or have they taken a stand against it?
Oh, yeah, let's go on to that. You know, there's people who told me that I could not oppose the federal government on this issue. But, you know, they're wrong. I'm getting other states to tell the federal government that no one is issued. I formed a coalition of states. It's called LORI, Legislators Against Real ID. And here in Missouri, I've got legislation filed for Missouri to oppose this, and I've sent this model legislation to other states. And to date, we have 8 states who have rejected the Real ID, where they've actually changed their state laws to say they will not go along with it. And we've probably got another 20 other states who have passed resolutions. Resolutions are not binding, but they sent it to their federal elected officials saying that they want to go on record as opposing it.
But, of course, the federal government is saying, you can't oppose this. We're in charge here. And it's saying, you're just not going to be able to get on a plane. You're not going to be able to travel. You know, you're going to have a passport. You want to get into a federal building. If you don't, we're going to punish you if you don't go along with our program, because we're here to protect you from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding over there in the cave in Pakistan.
Yep, that's, is that the way it's supposed to be? Is that we, the people, have to take back our country? Anyway, we are making progress in this. We're, telling the federal government that they've overstepped their bounds, that, you know, this is not a national security issue. It's a control issue that they're putting upon us. So I'm continuing to work. I think next year we'll get more states to change their laws to say that they will not go along with this. And hopefully, in their wisdom, that the federal government will vote and will repeal this Real ID Act and put in some sensible legislation to close our borders and start tracking those who come into our country who we think are terrorists, or at least put up some kind of a mechanism to screen those who we think are potential threats when they come into this country. You know, as long as, until we close our borders, it makes no sense to start continuing to track and identify those who's in this country. In fact, there is no wisdom in it. It's just the idea that someone wants to control this. They want to know where we are. They want to know our business now and in the future.
Well, you know, the crucial thing is that it should be very obvious that the current administration has no interest in stopping a terrorist from coming across our southern border. In fact, you know, Congress had voted for a fence that was 700 or 800 miles long, and they appropriated the money for it, and of course the instructions were given it was to be completed by about a year from now. And you know, the Bush administration has done everything they could to block the construction of that fence that was authorized by the state legislature. Are they free to? I thought the executive's purpose was to carry out the desire of the legislature, the federal legislature, not to simply have their own independent policy, independent of the wishes of the people.
That's what is happening. You know, we're getting so many executive orders issued to bypass the Congress, bypass the will of the people, and set policy out there. And that is wrong. You know, we've got this North American Union coming along, and for those who don't know what it is, the North American Union is a plan Mexico and Canada in with the United States into one union.
Hold up, though. We're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and Jim Guest is our guest for this hour. And he was just simply saying that there in Missouri, where he's in the legislature, he actually had gotten the state of Missouri to go ahead and vote to say, we're not going to go along with the RFID Act as far as individuals, the identification card for people. And then, of course, she's got a number of other state legislatures do exactly the same thing, and even a much larger number of state legislature to pass non-binding resolutions opposing this whole idea. So how many other states have joined Missouri in saying, we're not going to go along with this federal program? How many other states have passed non-binding resolutions supporting your position?
I think we have 8 states right now that have passed you might say, binding laws in their state that say they refuse to go along with it. You know, in essence, that says, you know, if the federal government says you can't get on an airplane if you don't have the real ID, then are these airlines going to avoid those 8 states? I don't think so. We may have a showdown come that point to see whether they can, the federal government can control the airline industry or not. And then, like I said, this other 20 states who have probably passed resolutions, I think some more of those will come back next year and pass laws to change theirs to actually make it binding. Next year is an election year. I think it's very important for those people out there who want to protect their freedom. They ask those congressmen and senators where they stand on the freedom issue. Are they going to protect the freedom of the people in that state? Or are they going to side with the government and require you to have a real ID so you can be tracked? And that can be a very important or very persuasive issue in an election year.
And I really think this is really so true. I think that anybody with half an ounce of intelligence has to realize that the federal government really doesn't believe in a war on terrorism. If they believed in a war on terrorism, they certainly would have sealed our southern border. If they really believed in a war on terrorism, why they would have, you know, gone ahead and built the fence that was authorized last year and was supposed to be completed a year from now. 700 or 800 miles of the fence is to be built along the 2,000-mile border. But, of course, they've even refused to only, they've built about 3 miles, and there's no way they're going to get the rest of this done. So, obviously, they have no intention of trying to block the terrorists. They are using the threat of terrorism to justify police state controls on the American people. That's what it's really all about. I mean, if they were really concerned about Osama bin Laden, they would have pursued him on into Pakistan and captured him. If they really were concerned about Osama bin Laden, they would have captured him when they had him holed up in the Torbau Mountains instead of letting him escape and refusing to allow the American troops who were there to actually try to catch him. So nothing as it appears to be, and certainly if they were concerned about Osama bin Laden, then why did they forget stop trying to catch him and actually then go to war with Iraq? Was that what it was really all about to begin with? And certainly was Osama bin Laden just a good excuse to justify that? Let me just read you briefly from page 180 of the book called, written by Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton, and it dealt with what was the 9/11 Commission report. And this is a fascinating book. It's called Without Precedent, and here's why, simply what it says. Condoleezza Rice was asked by one of the members of the 9/11 Commission, and I quote, "Why the Bush administration had not held senior-level meetings on counterterrorism before September 2001, and why more had not been done to take defensive measures in response to the threat of reporting over the spring and summer of that year." And Condoleezza Rice responded and pointed out that the nation simply wasn't prepared to take drastic action against Al-Qaeda before 9/11. Either abroad or in reforming government at home, and said, and I quote Condoleezza Rice, "Until there is a catastrophic event that forces people to think differently, that forces people to overcome all customs and old culture and old fears about domestic intelligence, then you don't get that kind of change." Let me repeat that. Until there is a catastrophic event that forces people to think differently, that forces people to overcome all customs and old culture and old fears about domestic intelligence, that you don't get that kind of change. In other words, we weren't going to change the American people's attitude about freedom until there was a major event. And boy, there sure was a major event. They didn't try to stop it. That comes from page 180 of Without Precedent, and you'll actually find the testimony in the 9/11 Commission report. Read it, understand, ladies and gentlemen, that they specifically did not try to stop the attack because they wanted to change our attitude. Well, Jim, you can't be very popular there in Washington, D.C., or with the Office of Homeland Security when you were standing in defiance of the elite who really want to control the population.
You know, that's right. I've heard that I'm not very popular going against what the bureaucracy wants to do. But, you know, once I think about this, and I thought, you know, I don't want to sit on my steps with my grandchildren and say, you know, I can remember back when America used to be free. I don't want to do that. I want to keep this country free, and I hope that our forefathers would look down and say, you know, I'm proud of what you're doing. That's what we did when we established the freedom and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights in this country. That's what it's about. And I think we've got many people out there who will join us in this. And if they want to learn more about this, we have a website. It's Legislators Against Real ID. And it's www.legislatorsagainstrealid.com. Or they can Google l.a.r.i. real ID, and it will come up, and that will give them some more information on it.
Oh, could they just actually Google in your name, Jim?
Yes. I've got so many articles out there on me that will probably bring it up. And also, you know, my travel around the country, I'm doing this on my own dime, and I've had a lot of people who want to, you know, contribute a few dollars to help me. And I've got a committee set up to do that. It's a Committee for America's Freedom, Box 601, King City, Missouri, 64463. And I get donations all over the country. I got some small check today from Texas. I get several from California. You just name it. People that hear me on this program and others, you know, want to help. You know, I can. It doesn't make any difference to the size of the donation. It can be a small amount or it can be a large amount, and just all it does is goes to pay for my travel. I went back to Williamsburg, Virginia, and spoke to the 16 southern states at their legislative conference, and there were several legislators that wanted a copy of the model legislation there. I went to Michigan to speak to the Midwest Legislative Conference a couple of weeks ago, and there were several states that you know, some of them had kind of heard about it, but they didn't realize the full implications of it, so they want copies of it to hopefully they can implement in their legislation, you know, next year. So it takes some work. We've got a lot of legislators around the country who have joined forces with me to work on this. But then, as you said earlier, yes, it's not very popular when you go against a program that somebody has set up in D.C. to take away.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jim Guest is our guest. And certainly, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Would love to hear from you. I'm sure Mr. Guest would be glad to answer your questions. Now, Mr. Guest, of course, is actually his website's out there. He does all this on his own. If you'd like to help him and like to contribute towards his travel, because, of course, he's spending a great deal of his time traveling and talking to legislators from other states and developing this groundswell of opposition in state legislatures to this idea that we will each have to have our own little card so that we can be tracked, so that we can thwart the efforts of Osama bin Laden, who wants to take away our freedom. And Jim, I'd like you to go ahead and get your web page out again, would you?
Okay. It's Legislators Against Real ID.
Legislators Against Real ID.
Lari, L-A-R-I, you know. And, or like I said, you can Google in my name, and I'm pretty sure it'll bring it up and several other things that I've been working on there. And that website does have, you can link on to this Committee for America's Freedom. I'll give that again. Committee for America's Freedom, Box 601, King City, Missouri, 64463. Today I got a check, and it was made out to Lori, Box 601. That is fine. They all go to help me in my travels out there and to continue to work with us. But we want the people to fully understand, unless the states ask for an extension, you will have to go into your local Department of Revenue to get a new ID, and you will not get that in a few minutes. It's going to take you many trips, and they are going to make copies of all the data that you bring in there. They're going to copy your birth certificate, your Social Security number, where you live. They're going to put that in a data file, in a database in that state. Everybody in any state can link onto that. This has to be shared with all other states. The Department of Homeland Security, in their wisdom, thinks we need to share this globally. That means some foreign country can link into our database. This can be the country where these terrorists are coming from. So you tell me whether somebody in D.C. is looking out for our security or whether they want to have control over us.
The answer
is pretty obvious.
I really think it's so funny. You know, I went to the doctor today for something just minor, but one of the things you have to do is you have to sign this special form that says, understand that they have a privacy policy dedicated to protecting our policy. And I've read the privacy policy, and I know that they're trying to protect my privacy so other people won't know what's going on about my personal matters having to do with health. And then if you sit down and you read the privacy policy, what it is that they can release the information on you to just about anyone they want to, and anybody who wants that information, has nothing to do with protecting your policy. It has to do with taking away your privacy. You see, they have to use words to conceal what they're really up to. And they want the information on your health. They want to know what books you read, and that's why they're checking the various libraries to see what books people are reading. But, of course, the librarian can't tell you they're checking out. If you do anything at your bank, you cast a large check, or you put a large amount of money in the bank, they have to report that to the government. All of these things are on your permanent record. They have massive data files on all the law-abiding citizens. They're not tracking the terrorists, ladies and gentlemen. They're tracking the law-abiding citizens, and they're setting up these files. And not just that the FBI, the military has their files on you, the Office of Homeland Security has their files, and then they merge them all together so that they know everything about you. And we have a wonderful 4-tape set on what happened in China as the communists took in and how they were monitoring the people. We're talking about back in the 40s, and this one missionary was there. They knew the number of shirts he had in his drawer, the number of handkerchiefs he had in his bedroom, the number of pairs of socks he had. They were monitoring everything about him before they took over. And if you've never heard our 4-tape set on China, you really need to take that to understand. Fast forward now, really, 60 years to where we are today. And there are people who are collecting similar files on us. And if you have a grocery cart and you buy groceries, they're keeping track of what you buy at the grocery store. You buy things with a credit card. All those files are kept. They have gigantic dossiers on the American citizens, and you have to ask yourself, why? If you're out there and they're listening out and you have a question or comment, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jack, do you have a question?
Indeed. I wanted to know if the guest is aware of what Alex Jones has said. That's the first question.
No, what has Alex Jones said?
Well, what he said is numerous cities and towns have passed their own local ordinances prohibiting the Patriot Acts.
This isn't the Patriot Act. This is simply RFID.
Right. I'm just thinking, Dr. Stan, that perhaps locally the people at the grassroots can force a mandate banning real ID and all this other.
Let's see what Jim is doing, because he's working with the state legislatures, and that covers a lot more people. What about the local communities passing resolutions?
No,
Jim, let him reply, please. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that. I think the biggest impact is when each state passes changes their state law to say, we will not go along with the Real ID Act. In Missouri, I want to pass a law that says the state cannot sell your personal information from your driver's license application or your tax returns. You mentioned the Patriot Act. Part of my 5 points to America's freedom is we need to repeal the Patriot Act, or as I call it, the Unpatriot Act, which allows your federal government to spy on your phone records, your bank accounts, and what have you. I guess you can get something done at the local level, but I think you're be much better if you do it at the state level to cover everything you have to do, whether you can supersede state law or not.
And I think really what's interesting, of course, is that the federal government wanted your picture, and what they did, you know, they went around to the states, and they actually paid the states, and they bought copies of the pictures off of all the driver's license, but they lied about it. They had to say, they said it was private companies, and they were doing this for credit card, certainly security, and it simply wasn't that case at all. They didn't want the American people to know that they want your picture, and of course they want to put that in the database so that we can, when they punch in your name, your picture will come up as well. Did you have another question, Jack?
Real quick, Dr. Stan, thank you for that. I'm going to call. I'm going to start getting on the phone with the legislators tomorrow.
Are you in California?
No, he's in Michigan.
Michigan. Oh, okay.
And I was going to ask... about the KGB fellas, I remember Mikhail Gorbachev, that Nobel Peace Prize winner, supervised U.S. base closures in the early 90s. Where have you interviewed the source, or where is the source that can be verified of the KGB agents that are directing? And as Jeannie last night said, Homeland Security is the Nazi SS.
Okay, fine. Correct. Thanks so much, Jack. Let's go ahead. And certainly, Jack just did mention that Gorbachev had been consulted when we were closing our military bases. If anybody would like to verify that, why, of course, we have the information and the articles about it. Why would we actually have Mikhail Gorbachev be involved with the closing of our military bases? That just doesn't make sense. And of course, Jack is wondering about the KGB agents who are working in Washington, D.C. Is this reported in any of the major media, Jim?
That's true. Back to the original question. I got one news article about, I think his name was Primakov, I'm not sure.
Right, uh-huh.
That was one of the top KGB agents that's working in the Department of Homeland Security.
Now, I know he's back in Moscow at the present time.
Oh,
I don't know
whether
he's ever over here, but certainly he may very well have been. I've heard the same stories. I've just never been actually able to verify it. But, you know, nothing would surprise me.
You know, that is, when they get people who have done that, and so... he said he's from Michigan, Paul Opsommer. I've been working with him very closely in Michigan to try and do that. I want to go a little bit farther than what Representative Opsommer is. He wants to get back where the states can at least sit down at the table and negotiate with the federal government on what kind of security we have here. I'd rather just outright ban the real ID and then start to sit down so the states have some say in it. And I've also got an email sometime today I haven't had a chance to look at from somebody else in Michigan that wanted some more information. So we're making some inroads here, making more and more states aware that they need to take action to protect the citizens of their state.
Well, Jim, I think what you're really doing is really wonderful, and it's very courageous of you, and I'm just so glad that you're out there doing this. I'd heard that other states, a number of states, had said we're not going to go along with the program. So the federal government, of course, is going to punish those states. They're going to punish people who do not want to go along with their agenda, because, after all, that their job is to protect us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave. Of course, he's been supposedly on dialysis all this time. I'm not quite sure how you manage dialysis hiding in a cave in Pakistan. I mean, it's a very, very sophisticated process. Being a physician, I can tell you that, I mean, you don't just sit down and just have your little dialysis. You have to be in a hospital doing it. In fact, you know, there are a lot of reports that Osama bin Laden's been dead for a long time, but we sure need somebody to be afraid of, so I guess he's as good as anybody. But what they're really doing is playing on the fears of the American people. Do you ever have that feeling, Jim, that they're exploiting us, that they want us to be fearful so that we will knuckle under and do exactly as we're told?
I was just thinking, as you were talking, I said, you know, why it's so difficult to catch Osama bin Laden? As long as he's loose, he's a threat. And people can fear him or any other terrorist attack on this nation. So as long as they can get the people to live in fear, it's easier to pass more laws or take action to control them, to know where they are, take away their freedom, invade their privacy. You're exactly right. You know, that's kind of what happened in Nazi Germany. You know, those people lived in fear there, and that was how that Hitler was able to gain control of them. Well, and there's a kind of parallel that's going on here right now.
Well, you know, the one advantage we have, they didn't have in Nazi Germany, is we got the Internet. So if you're out there in the listening audience, and I want you to go up on the Internet after the program is over tomorrow, and I want you to Google in Osama bin Laden died, and you'll find literally hundreds of hits on some of the fact that Osama bin Laden, and many reliable sources that say he's been dead for some years, but we can't let the American people know that. The other thing is, of course, go to the FBI website, 10 Most Wanted Men, and notice what the FBI says about Osama bin Laden. They never even mention in the most wanted poster where they're offering a $5 million reward for his capture. They never once mention 9/11. My goodness, the government says he was responsible for 9/11, but I guess they never told the FBI. But go up and check it out on the Internet, ladies and gentlemen, and then go ahead and check out Jim Guest. Jim is our guest tonight, so remember, Jim Guest from Missouri. And the legislation that he has, and he has, certainly model legislation there that's being passed, and get hold of your legislators, and if you can help Jim in your state, if your state hasn't already passed legislation, certainly coming out against this identification card. Here's something that you can do. Because I would like to suggest that we're not going to stop Osama bin Laden from taking away our freedom. Because, you know, the reason that Osama bin Laden attacked us is because we were free. And so we're not going to stop Osama bin Laden from taking away our freedom by taking away our freedom and requiring everybody to carry an identification card. And I wonder how many people out there really think that the terrorists are going to carry their identification card. So
I would say, you know, it's difficult to get these terrorists to stop us at the border when they come in so we can get their picture and give them a card. You know, terrorists and criminals don't abide by the laws. So if they think they're going to pass a law to require everybody to get a real ID card, you know, they're not going to do it. Some people say, well, I'd feel a little bit more secure if I was on an airplane with a real ID card in my pocket. I said, yeah, the person sitting next to you is going to have a fake real ID card in his pocket if that makes you feel any better.
Now, if I was on the plane, I would like to know that there was an air marshal on that plane to protect me. But you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that the government is so concerned about airline safety that there's probably less than one air marshal in every 10 flights, probably far less than that. If the government was really concerned about our safety on the planes, they would have deflectors on those planes in case there was a surface-to-air missile fired at it. I can assure you that they have these deflectors on Air Force One to protect the president, but none of our commercial airliners have them. Israel has them on their planes because they want to protect their people from terrorism, but we don't put them on our planes because it's just too expensive.
You know, I always wonder, people say, why do you think you have to have a driver's license to be a terrorist? You can walk into a building with a briefcase and set a bomb, leave a bomb there. You can strap one to you. You can even drive a car without a driver's license. So to think that you're going to stop terrorism by requiring people to have a real ID, you know, that's not going to work. They can do that even without it, or very easily will they be able to make fake IDs. These crooks and counterfeiters are very good at it. It would take just, in fact, they've already said that it would take them a very short time to start selling counterfeit real ID bills. You talk about you're trying to protect your identity. You know, all you have to do is about every day you find out somebody's security has been breached. It was only about a month ago that the state of Ohio lost a hard drive of all 64,000 state employees. That hard drive was lost with their bank data on it, their payroll data, their Social Security, and everything. You know, the Department of Homeland Security, their own transportation department, lost some data on over 100,000 of their employees here about a year ago. So before we even start putting all this data in our database in our state, we've already got it's difficult to protect it. So how in the world do you think that the employees in each state are going to protect your personal data when it's downloaded in there.
In fact, the Department of Veterans Affairs, apparently they lost all of the records on all of the veterans here. In fact, we got letters from the government saying somebody has stolen the records of from the Veterans Administration with your name and Social Security number and all your personal data on it. We want you to know they've stolen it. Now, why would they be that incompetent unintentionally? Or are they trying to frighten us that we need the government to, because somebody's trying to steal our identity? That's why we have to have a real ID card and with a chip in it, and maybe the next best thing will be simply to have everybody have a chip. So those terrorists won't be able to buy or sell unless they have the chip in their hand or maybe on their forehead. Ladies and gentlemen, what we're seeing is the most incredible scam of all time. And so many people are going along with it. Our guest has been Jim Guest, who's a very courageous man, taking a very courageous stand today. Well, Jim, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, very good. I would, so more people can, if they can't get all this information down, if they can go online and, like I said, Google in Jim Guest, or Google in Laurie, L-A-R-I, space, real ID. They can bring up some information, and I can certainly use some support if they want to send a contribution to the Committee for America's Freedom, or they can just make it out to Laurie, Box 601, King City, Missouri, 64463. But I want everybody out there that's listening to know that the freedom for your future and your children and the generations to come is really on the line. You've got to take this seriously here, what our federal government has planned for us and what they're implementing. It's not too late. Like our forefathers, they fought and stood up for the freedom of this country, and we can do the same thing. Call your state legislator or U.S. legislator. Ask them where they stand on it and ask them why they are not protecting your freedom and not making their voices heard. You know, united we can stand on this thing and we can defeat it. We know that our voices can be heard when enough people speak out, and now is the time to do that. So, I wouldn't say it's an uphill battle. We're making some good inroads on it. But when you're going against the federal government, they can bring pressures to bear on you and some people that's helping you. But then, this is a battle that we cannot afford to lose. If you like the freedom you have now, then you'd better work to protect it.
Well, have you had any opposition? I mean, any people putting pressures on you?
Oh, indirect. I've had some pressures put on me and some of my staff members here that sort of make it difficult for us to get our job done. There's some indirect threats, but then, the quest for freedom is strong enough that we're going to continue to battle forward.
Well, I certainly respect you for what you're doing, Jim, and certainly any time why you'd like to be on our programs, and I will call your secretary and try to get you on to our other programs. I think your message is important, and it's important to realize the effect that one person can have, one person with a vision, one person with virtue and honesty and courage. So I applaud your efforts, and certainly we need more legislators like you who are not there because, this is a way of getting power. They're there because they believe in this elusive concept of freedom under God, because without freedom, my life has very little meaning. God bless you. Thanks for everything you're doing, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Good night. God
Good
bless.
Night.
All right. I hope you enjoyed our program with Jim Guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I think that Jim is a very, very courageous individual. He's a legislator in the state of Missouri, and, of course, he is trying to get people to understand that this whole thing is a scam that's been planned a long time. They've always wanted, of course, to have everybody numbered, everybody having a card, and one day, of course, they want to get everybody chipped. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people, and they justify what they're doing into protecting us against the wicked Osama bin Laden. So, certainly we have an excellent book. It's called Spy Chips, and we have a number of fascinating interviews with Catherine Albrecht and Liz McIntyre, and several other people actually on these ideas for animals. They want to get the animals checked, chipped. They want to get the people chipped. They want to get a chip in your passport. They want a chip in your driver's license. They want to know everything about you. They're collecting dossiers. And if you have any question of collecting dossiers, the book, it's entitled Fixing Intelligence by Major General William Oldham, who headed NSA, the most secret of all of our spy agencies. And of course, in his book, written in 2003, he could not tell us what was going on, but he could ask questions like, should the CIA be assassinating people? Should the CIA have people planted in the media, journalists? Should the CIA and should the Army be keeping dossiers on American citizens? Do you think they should? Well, we hope many of you out there want to get the books by check. You can certainly specifically order the tapes that we have with Catherine Albrecht and other tapes on chipping of the animals. You can get a copy of this program. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But how do we really understand what's going on? Well, we understand really by understanding that there really are secret societies out there. In fact, someone once said that an understanding of the forces that have shaped the events of the 20th century is predicated not upon facts to be learned, but rather upon secrets to be discovered. And that's why my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, the book or the DVD, my talk on the Forbidden Secret, our four tapes or four CD set on The Secret, Behind the Secret, the award-winning DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and Riddles in Stone, and The Atlantis Connection, and The Emergence. All of these DVDs are so vitally important, because you're not going to hear these things elsewhere. Nobody's going to take you into the history of this movement towards the world government. They're going to tell you there's a movement towards world government, but they will never tell you what energizes the people behind this. And, of course, this is long-range planning of thousands of years. And it's all coming to pass right now. We do carry one book written by a Satanist named Manly P. Hall. It's called The Secret Destiny of America. It is actually not listed in our catalog. You'll have to request it specifically. The Secret Destiny of America by Manly P. Hall. We carry his other book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. We do not list them on our catalog because we don't want you to think we endorse what he says. But if you're a researcher and you really want to understand what energizes the people who are intent upon destroying our freedom and bringing about the world government, then The Secret Destiny of America explains to you exactly why we are fighting in the Middle East today for democracy. So anyway, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. You really need to get my three pamphlets set on the occult hierarchy. That's the occult hierarchy. And please don't forget, we're having an all-day seminar on the 28th of October. That's a Sunday. About it, it's going to be a great seminar. Hope you can make it. And if you're interested, we'd love to hear from you. 1-888-1-800-544. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And, well, today we're hoping to have, in fact, we have him on the line right now, Reverend Don Piper. And we're going to be talking about his book, 90 Minutes in Heaven. And it's a very, very powerful, very touching book. We carry the book because, of course, we believe it will help many of our listeners psychologically prepare for what I fear lies ahead. Because it asks the question, why do bad things happen to good people? So, I'm going to let Reverend Piper, tell you the story of 90 Minutes in Heaven. It is an amazing story, having less to do with the 90 Minutes in Heaven than of course, what happened to Don as a result of this. But, Don, thank you very much for being with us again.
Well, it's great talking to you again. I'm very honored to be on your program. Thank you very much.
Well, remember now, because this is an entirely different audience, so you can don't have to worry about being repetitive.
Sure.
Most of the people here have never heard your story, so why don't you just pick the story up and you tell it, and I'll just sort of sit here and listen.
Well, in 1989, I was coming home from a church conference as a pastor, you know, attend periodic conferences. I always felt like when you're through learning, you're through. So, you go to conferences and pick up some new ideas. I went to this conference. On the way home from the conference, in a rural area, because the conference center was in a rural area, I was trying to cross a bridge, a narrow two-lane bridge, and the tractor-trailer truck, an 18-wheeler, crossed the center stripe and hit my small car head-on without any warning. I had no opportunity to get out of the way. It didn't even see the truck coming. It all happened so fast. And I was a fatality in the accident, and of course we're having this conversation on the phone, so something must have happened for me to survive the accident, even though it was a head-on, really a horrible collision with a truck. And that's
accident,
the story.
The emergency personnel all considered you were dead.
Right. It was multiple car accident, three cars and the one big truck, and. Even though it was a rural area, they dispatched several ambulances out to the scene with all the medical personnel on board. They examined everybody. Thankfully, everybody was not injured except me. Everyone else was just taken away in other cars, and I was by four different sets of emergency medical technicians declared dead on the scene, and literally covered up with a tarp because all the windows had been knocked out of the car, and it was raining inside the car on the body. So they left me there and waited for a county official to come to the scene to sign the paperwork so the body could be removed to a mortuary.
All right. In fact, they had difficulty, couldn't even get you out of the car, wasn't it, that they your legs were pretty well trapped?
Yes. The collision with the truck literally went over the top of the car with the nine wheels on the driver's side of the truck, and it just kind of crushed the car, shoved it up against the railing of the bridge, and left me there in the car dead. So they had a lot of trouble getting me out of the car because it was wrapped around me.
All right, fine. Of course, there you are. You're covered with this tarp. You've been declared dead. And,
yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about what you experienced at that time, because that is the title of the book,
right?
90 Minutes in Heaven.
Right. I immediately, upon impact, was transported to the very gates of heaven, and I heard people talk about such things before, never a skeptic about the reality of heaven, because I've been preaching it for 20 years when the accident happened, but I was very skeptical that you could go there and come back and talk about it, and I really didn't have a near-death experience. I was dead for 90 minutes, so that's not nearly dead, so I got to see heaven.
Hold that though, we'll be back in just
sure.
A minute. All right, pick up the story there, please.
Well, I just was immediately standing at the gates of heaven, surrounded by people who I had known and loved in life, and they all were surrounding me. These are people who I didn't have a what you would call a Christian upbringing. My family were good folks, and they periodically attended church. But if I went to church, I'd depend on somebody else to take me. And so many of the people who had that kind of influence on me, they were people who had told me about Christ, who'd seen that I got to church, called me when I didn't go, and all those people were gathered at the gates to receive me, a welcoming committee, if you will, and they all looked wonderful. They were perfect, and I was so glad. When I saw them, I knew where I was because I knew where they were after they had passed away. I knew they went to heaven, and there they were at the gates to greet me, and they looked magnificent. If you want to look good, heaven is obviously the place you want to be because everybody looks good up there.
All right, fine. And, Chris, did you ever get through the gates into heaven?
I was going through the gates, and the gates themselves are quite magnificent. They look like they were sculpted out of the inside of an oyster. It's like what I would call mother of pearl. They really literally are pearly gates, and there really are streets of gold going inside. And I was actually, after hearing this magnificent music and incredible greeting by angels that were hovering all about us, I was actually going through the gates and seeing what was on the inside, which are some magnificent structures and really an infinitely bright light that crests this hill, kind of between a hill and a mountain. And that's where I had my eyes fixed, because I know that's where the Lord was, high and lifted up. I'm going through the gates, and at that time, back on Earth, there are people. A lot of people are praying for me because they don't know that I've been killed. All they know is that I've been in a really bad accident. One man knows that I'm a fatality, and he's just been directed by God to get in the car and pray for me, which he does. He's praying over me, and he's singing the great old hymn, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. I'm actually at the gates of heaven. At least he's singing it over my body back in the car. I'm going through the gates of heaven simultaneously. 90 minutes after the truck hit me, he's singing that hymn over my body in the car, under the tarp in the dark, even though it's the middle of the day. Thousands of people are praying for me around the world because they've been told I was in a bad accident, but they don't know I'm dead. All this prayer is being lifted up to heaven. I'm going through the gates of heaven, and suddenly, without any warning, I start singing with that man in the car, in the dark, and he just is completely shocked and gets out of the car very quickly.
Hold on, though, just a moment. We'll be right back here.
Sure.
With Don Piper. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Don Piper, and we're talking about what happened, and he's dead. He's been pronounced dead. He's covered up with a tarp. He goes to heaven. He sees a beautiful place. He's about to enter into the gates of heaven. We're down in the car. Why, he's a minister.
Yes.
Didn't know him. Didn't know Don at all.
No.
But he was just called to go to the car and pray. And everybody said, the guy is dead. What do you want to pray
right.
for? And he really had a feeling he had to pray for you, didn't he?
Well, it's a quite remarkable story. In fact, just this week, I met his widow, Anita. Anita and a Dick on a Record were the couple of the pastor and his wife, who were returning also home from the same conference, even though we did not know each other. We had not met at the conference. And he was behind me in the accident. His car was. He and his wife came up to the accident, and he just felt God spoke to him and said, pray for the man in the red car, which was me, of course. And he got in that car and began to pray for me. And the remarkable thing about it is that that's not something he would have normally done as a seminary-educated minister. Praying for dead people just did not, that was not included in his theology. But God told him to do it that day, and so he set his theology aside and was obedient, which is a rather remarkable turn of events. Anita and I were talking about this that week, but he was that kind of fellow. If God told him to do something, it didn't really matter whether it made sense to him or not. He knew it was the voice of the Lord, and he was obedient, and there's a real lesson there for us. It's not whether it makes sense to us or not. It's whether God's in it. And so he did. He got in the car and prayed for me, and 90 minutes after he started doing that, I returned. I was alive. And his life was changed as well as mine.
And so, of course, then they come with the jaws of life and they catch you out, and of course, then now they're going to take you to the hospital. But, of course, you've got terrible, terrible injuries. So
I did, yeah.
Why don't you tell the story?
Well, the impact was just so cataclysmic that my head was crushed by the weight of the truck rolling over the roof of the car. And it just, my heart had stopped beating, so even though I had blood coming out of the ears and eyes and nose and places like that, it had dried because the heart was no longer beating. And I was kind of impaled on the steering wheel. The round part of the wheel came off, and the shaft of the steering wheel entered my chest. The dashboard came across both of my legs because of the weight of the truck coming over the hood. My right leg was crushed at the knee. My left leg crushed just above the knee. And as a result of that, it just, it was like a guillotine that just severed the leg right above the left knee, and 4 inches of the femur, which of course the largest bone in the human body, was just ejected out of the car and never found. The right arm was not broken. It's the only thing I did not break. But the left arm was dislocated at the shoulder. It went over my back into the back seat, and the forearm from about halfway between the wrist and the elbow was all the bones were removed or broken, crushed, ejected, and that part of my arm from the midpoint of the forearm down was actually lying in the back seat of the car. So the injuries were absolutely devastating. Open, gaping wounds, many, many broken bones. It was a bloodbath in the car, horrible scene, and easy to understand why I did not survive the accident initially, but God obviously had another purpose, because not only did I return from that accident, but after 13 months in a hospital bed and 34 major operations, I did something they said I would never do, and that is walk again and use my left arm. And to this day, I still have them. They're not in great shape, but they're originals, and my anatomy has been kind of completely rearranged. But I did walk into where the building I'm in right now, and I'm going to walk out of here when I'm finished.
And of course, basically, then they transported you to a hospital, then they took you to a larger center, and this must have been a very painful experience for
you. It was a difficult experience. I by that time, of course, I initially was in shock, and I went to a clinic and then a hospital, and they said there's just not anything we do to him. We've got to transport him to a trauma center, and that was about 60 or 70 miles away. The weather was so inclement that day they could not fly the Life Flight helicopters, so they actually had to transport me by land 65 miles away. It was a harrowing ride in that ambulance at high speed, because I was in such grave condition. It was at that point that the shock had worn off and the pain began to set in, and every time my heart would beat, there was just excruciating pain at every one of those broken bone sites, and there were many of them. I don't know that I have ever experienced before or since anything quite as devastating. I asked for more pain medications, and they told me they couldn't give me any more because they didn't want me to lose consciousness. They were afraid that if they did, I would never be able to regain consciousness. And so I just kind of lay there in excruciating pain. I finally asked the emergency medical technician if he could give me anything for pain, could he at least make the other people, and I assume they were other injured people in this massive wreck, if it could make the other people in the ambulance be quieter, because the screams and the moans were really very disturbing. And he put his hand on my shoulder, I'll never forget this, and he said, "Sir, there are no other people in this ambulance. Those sounds, those screams, those are coming from you." And it's probably the most frightened I've ever been in my life, to realize that I was so badly hurt and so in such enormous pain that I was not even conscious of the fact that I was screaming and that I was making those moaning sounds. Very disturbing.
Well, anyway, Chris, they get you to the hospital, and, of course, they get you into traction. And,
yes.
And the doctors are really in a terrible situation.
Yes.
Because, of course, they've got you, certainly, with one leg, got four inches of your feet.
Yes.
And what do you do when you got a leg and 4 inches of the bone is gone? And
that's right.
Sure, there was a question about taking off the leg, wasn't there?
There was, and unfortunately, very soon into this this time in the ICU, as they were trying to really determine a game plan for saving both limbs, the arm and the leg, I developed pneumonia in both lungs. And so I was in, once again, critical condition. One night, 6 days after the accident, they summoned my wife into the room and said, Mrs. Piper, you have a very difficult but a very simple choice to make. We're either going to have to remove your husband's leg tonight, because if we don't, we're not able to elevate him to do breathing treatments and the things that we need to do to take care of his pneumonia. He's going to end up dying of the pneumonia unless we either take the leg off so he can be elevated, or we perform a very experimental treatment at this time called a bone growth device. It's an external fixator called an Elizaroff. And she had to make a decision as to whether to put that on. Only five had ever been applied in the United States up to that point on femurs. And so she decided to try that. Obviously, I was not consulted because I was not in condition to make any decisions. And so she did that. I woke up the next morning with a device embedded in my leg, 30 puncture wounds that went through the flesh, through the bone, and out the other side. And I was to wear that for 11 months. And it was a very difficult, trying time. But the other side of it is that it works. She just had to make that decision that would affect our lives for the rest of our lives. And it's a very courageous lady. She's the hero of my story.
Well, anyway, of course, you put on this Elizaroff, and of course, I'm acquainted with that because, as you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and although I never pulled one on, I read about this. It was developed by a Russian orthopedist and as a means of lengthening the bone. Of course, yours, it was just preserving the alignment and then letting the bone
correct
eventually fill in. So you wore this thing for 11 months.
That's right.
And that must have been a terribly tedious and painful time for you.
It is. It's an extraordinarily difficult thing. I have one all on my arm as well, left arm, but only for about 6 months on the arm, because they did actually bone transplants in the arm. Those bones are small enough that there's some comparable areas, including the pelvis. They were able to harvest bones and put in the arm, and they were able to keep that length of time down to a shorter period of time. The leg, they actually turn screws on the leg four times a day, every 6 hours, and stretch the bones that are inside the leg after having broken it again above where the initial break was, and they stretch the bones to close the gap where the bone is missing. It's quite ingenious, but as you might imagine, dragging a series of pins and wires through your legs by turning screws is quite a painful experience, in addition to all those open wounds where the wires and the pins go. You have to pour hydrogen peroxide into those wounds every day to kind of keep the chances of infection down, because even after having this on your leg for such a long period of time, you could still lose the leg by getting an infection in any of those open wounds. So it's a very tedious, long, drawn-out, painful process. The good news is that it worked, and I'm walking on that leg today.
Well, of course, the interesting thing is you tell the story of what happened, and of course, your emotional response to this, your anger, your frustration.
Yeah.
Why should this happen to me?
Right. I had a difficult time with it. I guess one of the things that people have found appealing about the book is that it's an unvarnished book. They may have bought it to read. I never hand the book to somebody and say, "I hope you enjoy this." It's a painful experience. It was difficult for me. I probably didn't handle it as well as I could have. At least I think so. I became very depressed because the doctors, in spite of their best efforts, could not really guarantee that it was going to work, and they didn't know how long it would take to work. So you can imagine day after day, week after week, month after month of having no good news, it began to wear on me. I became very depressed. They tried to help me, and I didn't really want any help. I figured I'd just kind of suffer silently and get over it someday. So I wasn't really good at this. I had a tough time trying to make the adjustment and get some hope. I was looking for hope.
And of course, one of the stories you tell about how people would try to help you and you didn't want them to help you.
No, I didn't. I thought I was relieving them of the responsibility. I thought I was being selfless, and the truth is I was being selfish by denying them of the opportunity to bless me, which is really what they wanted to do. They wanted to help me, and I wouldn't take their help.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a few moments with Don Piper. Well, Don, why don't you go ahead and tell the story of this minister friend of yours who was there to counsel you and try to get you through this such difficult period.
Well, you know, I don't want to be, I mean, maybe to make it to sound disingenuous or anything, but if you could find a friend who's an 80-year-old retired pastor, find one, because they're great. They're great, great people. And I was fortunate enough to have a gentleman in my life like that. His name was J.B. Perkins, and he was just a great gentleman who had spent his entire life devoted to helping other people, and I loved him very much. He would come and see me, and it was a 40-mile one-way drive to the hospital. He would come see me at least two or three times a week, so it was a real commitment for him to have to do this. But he was always faithful, and he always had a good word. But by this time, I was not doing very well mentally and emotionally. And he knew that, but one day he observed me being not brusque, but borderline. Somebody had come to say, you know, can I get you something before I leave? Can I get you a magazine or something like that? And I said, no, I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for coming. And I'm sure it must have come across as not being very insincere. So that person left, and J.B. Perkins came over to my bed, and he said, you need to get your act together. And I was so caught off guard by him saying that. I said, sir, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, you're doing a terrible job of letting people take care of you, which I did respond to that. I said, I don't want people to take care of me. I really wish they'd all go away, and then I could suddenly somehow get over this so they wouldn't have to worry about me. He says, but they want to take care of you. It's all they have. If they could trade places with you, they'd do that. They care about you that much, but you're denying them a blessing. Well, I'd heard that before, but it didn't really register with me, and he really began to kind of get to me as he was talking about, you've spent your entire life ministering to other people. Why is it that when you need them, you won't let them minister to you? And I didn't have a good answer for that. My first response was I was kind of taken aback. He was kind of lecturing me, and I wasn't used to being lectured like that. But he made me promise before he left that I would try to do a better job of letting people care for me because it's the only gift they had to offer. They couldn't heal me. They couldn't, you know, all they could do is try to make my life, the quality of life, a little bit better. So I promised him that I would do it, but I didn't really want to. But as I began to do that, I began to see how right he was. These people really did. It was their way of saying, we care about you. And it might have just been bringing a magazine from the gift shop downstairs or bring me a milkshake because I lost 80 pounds, you know. They were just trying to do something nice, and it made them feel better. It made them feel worthwhile, like they were making a contribution to my recovery. That's one of the best lessons I learned from this experience. I had to get hit by a big truck to figure it out, but, you know, ministers and men in particular, I think we don't always do a great job of letting people love us back. And when I began to let people love me back, it really did change them, and it changed me too. So it was a wonderful lesson to learn. I'm still working on it. You know, I'm a work in progress, but it began in the hospital with J.B. Perkins looking at me and saying, you are a hypocrite, he said. You want to help other people, but you won't let them help you.
And certainly your book is just so frankly honest. You know, the imperfections, we're all imperfect.
Yes.
I can see in many of the things you describe my own imperfections. And perhaps I think that the one reason your book is so fantastically successful is you're so brutally honest about your own shortcomings.
Yes.
I wish we could all be that honest. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here.
Yes.
Well, this is Arthur Stan, and certainly, then, of course, this is very difficult for your family. Your wife has got to go to work, you want to talk a little bit about the personal problems you have, because, I mean, this is a devastating financial situation and a crushing blow to you and your family as well.
Well, it was. Even though the church continued to pay my salary, when they certainly weren't in any way obligated to do so, because I was not able to work, just the sheer logistics of staying in the hospital and having people come and see me and have my wife come up every day, the parking rates and the travel back and forth. We had three children, and they weren't able to stay at home, of course. One was in middle school, and she actually went to live with one of the high school football coaches and his wife because they had a daughter her age. Our two sons, twin sons, were 8 years old. they had to be taken to a grandparent's house 250 miles away so that they could be taken to school every day and have some semblance of a normal life. My wife, who is a teacher, ran out of all of her sick days, her time off days, you know, everything she had. She was threatened with termination. They weren't trying to be mean. I mean, they just were trying to obey the rules. Other teachers donated their days off. She ran out of those, and finally she just had to go to work. So the church organized something they cleverly referred to as the Dawn Patrol, D-O-N, not D-A-W-N, Dawn Patrol, and they came every day after I was eventually taken home from the hospital. They constructed a hospital room in my home, complete with bed and trapeze and all the different things that you have to have in a hospital room. They came every day for about 4 or 5 hours and sat with me, prepared a meal for me, while she went to school and taught. So our life was completely chaos for nearly a year before we found any semblance of normalcy again. And so it was the sacrifice of all those people. I can remember lying in the hospital bed at home, looking out the window of the patio, and I could see high school boys out there mowing the lawn. They would just drive by the house and saw that it needed to be mowed. They'd go home and get their mower, come out and mow the lawn. Tears would just roll down my cheeks as I saw them out there because they knew I couldn't do it. My children were all gone somewhere else. They never thought twice about it. They just did it. So it was an enormous learning experience. It was an incredible testimony of love and devotion that these people who had prayed for me to live now were having to actually put feet to their prayers. They were having to do something to help us. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I don't recommend going through these kinds of things, but you know, your listeners, many of them are going through these kinds of things. Difficult, painful experiences, losses, tragedies, circumstances. And it's really not the tragedy so much, it's how we deal with it, how we process it, how we make it through to the other side. So that's what the book is about. I guess that's why people have seemed to have found it so appealing.
And of course, you simply, you're laying there here, you got both legs in.
Yes.
Now, what do they have? You have the device on one side. What's on the other side? How are they immobilizing the other?
I had a cast. It was just a cast.
You got one arm, and of course, you got the other arm's casted, and then one leg in a cast, the other in this.
The other arm had a fixator in it, but it also, the other arm, during the first 5 or 6 months, was actually lined with IVs. So it, even though it didn't break the right arm, it was immobilized because I had IVs in it, and I could, of course, couldn't be moved from one place to the other without dragging those with me. So for all practical purposes, all four limbs were not useful at all. I was completely, utterly, totally incapacitated. I could not do anything for myself.
And really, what a terrible, terrible situation to be in. And, of course, I've taken care of people, but, I can't think of anybody being laid up that long a time, and especially a younger person.
Yeah, I was just 39, or 38, actually, when the accident happened. So it was, what many of us would call the prime of life, hardly ever be more healthy and virile and full of energy. And I was just completely, I couldn't do anything, nothing, absolutely nothing.
And so you're laying there, and all you can do, of course, is just wait. And it's, the weeks move into months, and the months, of course, it's how long is it is before you're finally able to get the brace off your leg and at least try standing up?
It was probably 8 months before I was able to be elevated to a kind of a horizontal position again because I had been so long, my equilibrium rearranged itself. So learning to stand, just stand up was quite a challenge. And then several more months after that, it was almost 2 years after the initial impact that I finished most of the therapy. I was able to walk with only a cane, and then eventually, about 2.5 years later, walk unassisted totally.
And of course, I'm sure that many people read this book, and of course, really, I think the reason the book is so successful is because of the impact that you were able to have on other people's lives.
Well, I...
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead there.
I think probably one of the decision I made when I was at my lowest point, and that was one morning at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hospital bed, when I just really had kind of hit the wall. I didn't really know whether I was going to be able to go on. I didn't know where this was going to wind up. I didn't. No one could give me any definitive answers about essentially anything. And I just hit the bottom. And I've said on many occasions, there's only really one good thing that can happen when you hit the bottom, and that is push off. At least when you're on the bottom, you can push off. And I just had to do that. I had to decide that morning that I was not going to be. I just wasn't going to be defeated by this. Since I couldn't find anybody who identified with me, I couldn't find anybody who had lost 4 inches of femur like this and worn one of these devices, and it's because no one had in the country, a handful of people, and I didn't know who they were. I decided I was going to be the go-to person on that, take the emphasis off myself, and try to make sense out of what had happened to me. I felt like if I could help someone else get through this, then maybe it would help me get through it eventually, and maybe process the pain and the depression and all the things that I went through. When I got out, I began to look for opportunities, and I didn't have to look very far. I mean, they began to come in avalanches, and they still do to this day. So I look forward to being a person who's a resource person for folks that have really suffered, struggled, and had a difficult time. And in the past few months, I mean, I'm going in just a few weeks to Enterprise, Alabama, to speak to the high school where those 8 young people were killed by the tornado just a few weeks ago. I flew to Lexington, Kentucky to meet the pilot of the Comair flight that crashed there last year. He is the sole survivor of the airplane. 49 people tragically perished in that accident. He survived. I went to see him. He lost one of his legs and was horribly injured. So I know now why I had to go through what I did, and it's because I could try to help other people go through the similar experiences. I've been knocked down, but I haven't been knocked out. I've been beaten up, but I haven't been beaten, and neither have the people listening. They've been through some terrible, difficult times, but I think if we take the focus off of us and put it on what God can do through this experience, then we begin to make sense out of it. That makes sense out of the verse of the Bible that says, all things work together for good for them that love the Lord. And even though some things don't seem very good at the time they're happening, they could still be used by God to minister to other people, and that's what I want to do. I want to create that new normal for other people.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Don Piper. His book, 90 Minutes in Heaven. And we carry the book. We think it's a very important book. And the reason we think it's important is because we want to prepare people for the very possibility, very real possibility, that we, many of us, are going to face very difficult times ahead of time. And you have to ask yourself, why would God allow such a terrible thing to happen to a good person? And certainly, Don was a minister, had been practicing, been a minister for 20 years and preaching and helping people, and suddenly he faces this terribly devastating experience. And of course, the book recounts so many of the stories of how then, after he was able to get up and around again, he was able to just reach out to people. I remember you telling this one story about you were being in a theater and seeing some young fellow wearing one of these external support devices. What do you want to tell that story? I thought it was really so touching and apropos.
You're referring to the young man I met at the big conference?
Right. Well, yes. Anyway, you had to go up the stairs to get...
I did, yes. I was taking a group of young people to a large conference in a very large church. And circumstances would happen, we got a very late start because... one of the young ladies got there late, so I was kind of not very happy about that. We got in the bus, and we got to the place, and we unloaded. And when we got in, they had closed all the elevators because I guess people were maybe abusing them or something, and you had to climb steps. I was not long out of leg braces by that time, so I was not climbing stairs very well. I still don't. I probably had to climb 100, 120 steps to get up to where the only remaining seating was left, and that was because we were so late. And kind of fuming all the way up there about the steps. And when I got up there, I looked over a couple of sections, and I was leaning against the wall. I was so out of breath, I couldn't even sit in a chair. And there was a young man with one of these devices on his leg, and my heart just went out to him. He had his face buried in his hands, and this was a very uplifting conference. People were waving their arms, and they were singing songs, and it was just a great celebration. Well, he was not celebrating at all. I walked over there a couple of three sections over from where my young people were seated, and put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, I know that thing on your leg hurts. And he looked up at me as if to say, well, that's about the most obvious. I mean, of course it hurts. It's awful. And he said, yes, sir. And I said, well, I know, because I had one on my leg. Well, his demeanor changed immediately. He said, you did? And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it through this. And I said, well, I know you don't think you're going to be able to make it through it, and you will probably think that a lot, but you will. He said, well, how? And I said, well, it's going to be a day of a time experience, and you're going to have to believe that when it's all over with, you're going to be able to walk again. He says, I don't know if that's true. I said, I didn't either. I really didn't either. I said, but I promise you, you found somebody who knows how you feel. He says, you're the first person. I said, I know that. I said, we're a small fraternity of people, thankfully, who've had to go through this. I know how you feel. I know how you hurt. I said, I'm going to give you my phone number. You call me 24 hours a day. When you hit the wall and you don't think you could take it anymore, you want to scream, you want to take some wrenches and take that thing off your leg, you just call me up and we'll visit some. I'll pray with you. I'll listen to your gripes or your moans or whatever you got. I said, you found a friend now who understands how you feel. Well, he began to weep. I put my arms around him. He was 17 years old. And I prayed for him, and I said, now, when I get finished, I want you to watch what I'm going to do. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to walk right back over there where my young people are seated, and I want you to watch me walk, because one of these days I think you're going to do the same thing. He hugged me one more time, and then I walked with great determination, because I wasn't walking very well, but I at least tried to walk very well that day. And I walked back over, and I turned around and waved at him, and he waved back at me. And we formed a relationship. He began to call me every two or three weeks when he was just feeling down. And now that young man is out of high school and out of college and doing just fine. But during that time, it was a very difficult time for him. And I know it was difficult because I felt that way myself. So God's given me opportunities like that, and I look forward to them.
And, of course, there have been lots of them impacting on people's lives because of this terrible thing that had happened to you.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, you know, it's not what, as I said, it's not what happens to us. Because if we live long enough, and this is not pessimistic, it's realistic. You know, sooner or later we're going to lose loved ones, we're going to have a crisis. My writing partner who helped me write the book, is one of the dearest friends I have on earth. His house burned to the ground earlier this year, and in that house, was his son-in-law perished. Cecil Murphy, and, is the man's name. His name's on the front of the book because he helped me write the book. Well, I mean, what an awful experience to go through. And yet, I talked to him just a couple of two, 3 days ago, and he's going to rebuild his house, and they have a scholarship established for his son. He's taken this awful experience that he's gone through, and he's finding a new normal through that. And nobody knows better than he, because he and I sat down and wrote this book together. So bad things do happen to good people, people doing the right thing, not in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's not that they do happen, they do. It's how do we process them? What do we do with those to God's glory and our good? And that's what it's all about.
Amen to that. And Chris, this is really a very, very inspirational book. And I know it had a tremendous impact upon my wife, and it had a tremendous impact upon me, partly because, of course, I could empathize with Don, because I put many of the similar devices on many of my patients.
Yes.
but of course I fortunately never had to go through anything as he's had to go through, and yet he has impacted on so many people's lives because of this experience. How many copies of your book are out now?
Well, the 90 Minutes in Heaven book, the first book, is now a little over 1.6 million copies. In the regular edition, it's in 20 different languages, so I can't really account so far for how many copies it sold worldwide. And it's also available in a 5-CD version for people who are unsighted or need other help because they're not able to read the book. It's in a large print version. And then Cease and I have also written a follow-up book called Daily Devotions, inspired by 90 Minutes in Heaven. It's 90 stories for help and healing. And a lot of the stories that have happened since the writing of 90 Minutes in Heaven, which are quite remarkable, in some cases even more remarkable than the ones that are in the first book, we've included in this next book. And it's been very well received. It's published by Penguin Putnam, Berkeley Praise, as opposed to the first book, which is Fleming Ravel. And then we have a new book coming out in August, which is about the new normal I spoke of earlier, how to have a meaningful life after tragedy and loss. And it's called Heaven is Real. And I'm really excited about this book. This is the book I always wanted to write about how to get past losses and heartbreaks and tragedies and the difficulties. And that book will be out in August of this year, 2007.
And, of course, I think the book is important because it will impact on anybody who reads it. And when you wrote the book, you really didn't anticipate it would have this sort of a phenomenal response.
No, not at all. I often said when I wrote the book originally, I knew I could probably count on my mother to buy a copy, and I thought maybe my church members would buy a copy. And the first run was only 6,000 copies. And I thought, well, boy, if we can sell these, this will be great. Otherwise, I'll be storing them in the garage for the rest of my life, and now it's sold, 1,600,000 copies, and they anticipate by the end of this year, it will go over 2 million copies. So God had another plan. The company calls it, instead of calling it 90 Minutes in Heaven, they call it 90 Minutes in Inventory because it just keeps selling. But people are looking for hope. They want to know that we can have that heaven is real, and I know it is because I saw it. And they want to know that you can have a meaningful life between now and heaven. And you can, because Jesus said he came that we might have life abundantly. And we may not be free from pain or tragedy or loss or difficulty, but we need not be defeated. We don't have to be defeated by it. And that's where I think the crux is. I think that's where the strength is. And so I want to offer hope, because Jesus offered hope.
Well, would you like to get your web page and your telephone number up? Because I understand you go all over the world talking to
I do. Audiences. I'm actually right now in Hawaii, and I will be preaching 5 times this week in Hawaii at the various different places. So this is what I do. Once again, I never planned to do this. I was serving a local church and would have been contented to do that until either Jesus came or he took me home the final time. But in a very real sense, I do travel now and share the 90 Minutes in Heaven story in person. I guess there's something about seeing me walk in and knowing what I went through that kind of encourages folks, because I do walk in, and even though I've just, they told me I never walk again, the doctors and nurses and medical people work some miracles, and God did too, and so I'm able to do that. My website is donpiperministries.com. That's plural, donpiperministries.com. The book is, there's a good website called 90minutesinheaven.com, and it's kind of an interactive streaming video of some interviews with me, and shows the book and things like that. And then, as I said, the other book, the new book, Daily Devotions, is actually on the Penguin Putnam label. And that's you can find that also by getting on Penguin USA .com, and then that's the new book will also be on that too. So I'd love to hear from folks. We have a prayer chain, and we pray for folks in need, and anything we can do to try to help people. I think that's why I'm still here, and I'm going to keep doing it until he takes me home.
Well, I think it's changed your whole ministry.
Yes.
Because I'm sure that you a book with a distributing 1.6 million copies, and then in other languages, and going
yes.
towards 2 million, is going to have an impact. And, ladies and gentlemen, when you read this book, it'll have an impact on you, I promise you. I don't think you can read this book without it having a lasting impression. And yet, it was never intended to do that. It was simply to record the story of what had happened.
Yes.
But I believe God has used this book, and is certainly using your ministry to touch people all over our country, because most people today are getting increasingly cynical. most people have sort of a feeling of hopelessness, and yet, of course, I think your book gives them a cause for hope.
Well, they do. It's a difficult world in which we live, and because of the information explosion that we have, we are exposed to so many more tragic and painful things on the nightly news and in the front of the papers and on the internet. And if you just kind of sat there and read it and took it all in for a while, I mean, it's a wonder people don't live in a continual state of depression. It's not very hopeful. But we know we're not of this world. There is a better world than this, and that's what Jesus said when he said, "I go to prepare a place for you." But we're here for a reason, and we have to find that reason. It's not a secret. God wants us to know what it is. And when we find it and we do it, and, you know, you meet people who are doing what God made them to do, you can see how happy and contented they are. Doesn't mean they're free from loss or difficulty, but you can see in their lives that they're really doing what God made them to do. I think that's what we're here for. We need to find that and do it. I feel like I'm doing it because this is not what I planned to do. I couldn't be further away from what I had planned to do and laid out for myself, and that tells me that I must be in the center of God's will because I'm not doing what my will. I didn't do what I particularly wanted or planned to do, but I've never been more fulfilled and excited. I'm a little weary most of the time, but it's okay. I'm going to do it as long as I am physically able to do it, and it's very humbling and very overwhelming, very exciting, but it makes a little more sense now that I went through all that stuff, very difficult stuff, because it helps me now help other people through the same thing.
Yeah, of course, Don's son works with him and does his scheduling.
Yes.
And you're really on the, certainly out most of the time in other communities, aren't you, giving talks?
Well, this year, I'll be in 29 states in the U.S., and then also I'll be back in the U.K. and probably in Sweden later on this year. And the book has been very successful in Scandinavia, so I've been able to preach probably 30 or 40 times in Sweden and Norway and the Netherlands. I've preached across the U.K. I've preached at a big church in Mexico City and several places in Canada. So, yes, it's opened a lot of doors to take the gospel into places that actually don't have much in the way of active evangelical churches, and so it's been a real thrill to be able to do that in a lot of places. And with the other languages coming on board now, Korean, Japanese, Indonesian, Chinese, it looks like it's going to open up the other side of the world too. So it's very exciting, also very overwhelming, but I just take it a day at a time. That's all we've got. You know, I was a preacher on his way to church when the truck hit me. And it reminded me, as if I needed reminding, that we live on the edge. You know, any day could be our last day, and we ought to squeeze the tube. You know, make them all count.
I'm often reminded of that little saying that between man's plan in time and God's plan in eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Well said.
And, of course, really, you see in the, really your impact on other people's lives. But I think we'd all like have an opportunity to, but I sure wouldn't want to have to go through with what you went through.
No, no. I said a lot of times, people say, well, I really liked your book. And I said, well, I don't recommend getting hit by a truck so you can write one. But, you know, if you do have a great sadness or a loss or tragedy, it probably ought to do something that's worth talking about. It ought to do, if you make it through to the other side, and that, I think that's what God would have for us to do, we ought to give him the glory and help other people do the same thing.
Amen to that. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to ask Don a question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and we're just about out of time, but our guest has been Don Piper. His book, 90 Minutes in Heaven, a book that I promise you, when you read it, will really transform your life in many ways. It's one of those unforgettable books that we're carrying along. We carry Corrie Ten Boom's book, and we're recommending for people just to prepare themselves spiritually for what I believe is going to lie ahead for many of us. Well, basically, what message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening, Tom?
Well, I would like people to know that God answers prayer. I'm a living testimony of answered prayer. Literally, untold numbers of people prayed that day that I would live, and God said yes. Sometimes the answer to prayers is no, but God is faithful to answer prayers. The Bible says we have not because we ask not. So I would tell them God answers prayer. Keep praying. I would say God's still in the miracle business because I'm a miracle. I would also say that you can find a new normal on the other side of tragedy and loss. And I would also say heaven is real and Jesus is the way to heaven. He said he was. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man goes into the Father except through me. So if I don't get to see him here on this side of the gate, I hope to see him up there.
All right, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Don's been kind enough to come on with us the second time for a different audience. We hope one time we'll get him on with the other audiences. As you know, we do 4 hours of four different audiences every week. But I felt that this was such an important message to get out, and Don's over in Hawaii. Would you be giving a talk this evening over there? You're going to have to
actually, my first speaking engagement is Good Friday at a church called Mountain View Community Church in Kaneohe. And then I'll be at Hope Chapel in Honolulu on Saturday night and back at the Mountain View Church for a couple of Easter Sunday morning services. And then I'll be back over the Big Island on Monday night.
Now, what island are you on now?
I'm on Oahu.
All right, fine, because we do actually have listeners over there. In fact, we have listeners all across the country, but I know we have a fair number of people who monitor our programs from Honolulu, and so hopefully some of them will get a chance to get to actually hear Don Piper when he's
going
to
speak. I would love to meet them, or anywhere, really, that we're able to get together. I enjoy meeting people on this side of glory that I'm going to spend eternity with on the other side.
Right, and of course, certainly, if you'd be interested in having Don come to your church, why, you would contact, and let's get that telephone number and website out just one more time.
The website is donpiperministries.com, and there is a place on there that says contact Don or speaking engagements, and you can just check on that. And then the office number is 281-991-1331, 281-991-1331, and as I said, I love meeting people in person here on Earth because, you know, we don't get to stay very long here. But I like to meet them here before I get to see them up there. And we're trying to take as many with us as we can. Heaven is real, and we want to make sure that people get there.
Amen to that. Well, God bless you. Thank you so
very
much for being with us.
Very honored to be with you today.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, of course, that's Don Piper. And it's a fascinating story, a fascinating book, and we certainly recommend it to it. Of course, if you're interested in getting the book, learning how to get the book, why, you can always give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we actually decided to carry this book because we think that, especially at this time in history, people need to begin to understand that there may be difficult times that lie ahead. But, of course, God is going to see us through if it's his plan. If it's not his plan, we're going to perish. But if once you accept that really our life is not in our hands, but our life is in God's hands, then, of course, it's much easier to accept what lies ahead, and this book will help you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us. And if you agree with our message, and as you know, we reach out across America to about 60 outlets every week. What a unique opportunity through the miracle of radio and shortwave and internet and the satellite now on Telstar 5, and you can actually hear us there 9 hours a day. Of course, you won't even have time to get anything accomplished, but we actually do have some people who listen for 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day. We try to bring you the information we think will help you prepare for the difficult times that lie ahead and will help you to educate others about what's going on. And we've decided to carry Don Piper's book, 90 Minutes in Heaven. Now, if you'd like to get the tape of this conversation or, of course, our previous conversation, you get either one or both of them. And we do talk through some of the breaks that you may hear if you're on a commercial radio station. But the book or the audio tape are available by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope, of course, that you will be able to utilize this book, and you may even want to share it with others. And, of course, the basic theme is that God allows terrible things to happen to good people. But it's for a purpose. And just as I'm firmly convinced that God is going to bring his judgment on America, but it will be for his purpose, and I think the same thing is going to be happening in Israel in the very near future, and probably in nations all throughout the world. But it probably will be the only thing that will offer people any hope for a better world and a better life, because right now, of course, we're living in a pagan world, a world that certainly does not honor God. And America doesn't honor God. And there is no way that America is ever going to be redeemed unless we turn from our wicked ways. And I see very little evidence of that at the present time. Anyway, of course, if you'd like to get the book or any of the other items we talk about, why, if you'd like more information on how to obtain them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and we do recommend my new talk. It's called Forbidden Secret, and it's available on video, it's available on DVD, and of course it's an important story, because it will help you to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged today. My talk, Brotherhood of Darkness, is still a classic, and between that and The Forbidden Secret, you will know more than most college professors. We recommend, of course, Chris Pinto's wonderful DVDs, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2. We recommend his talk on the secret mysteries of America's beginnings and his most recent presentation, Riddles in Stone, the Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And you may wonder what this has to do with anything. Well, you're going to have to see them to watch, find out. And then, of course, Pastor Joe Schimmel's videos on DVDs, they sold their souls for rock and roll. They sold their souls for rock and roll. And because many of the people within the music industry have actually traded their soul for fame and fortune and drugs and sex and all of these things. But there's a terrible price to pay. And you can see the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. But they all tell the same story. And when you realize this is not just in the music industry, it's in education, it's in the media, it's some of the people at the highest levels of our government and heading the largest corporations in the world today. We're involved in this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So please, of course, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Don Piper, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and so until, well, tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating from the void of Yah's creation, it is Wednesday, the 4th of June, 2008. And yes,